Rick's report at noon, in the middle of the day, this Tuesday, the 24th of April, 73. Channel on 2 right, and Rick's report in the middle of the day, this Tuesday, the 24th of April, 72. Channel 2 right, and Rick's report in the middle of the day, this Wednesday, Tuesday, the 24th of April, 72.
Debbie at lunch the other afternoon, and I realized I was singing something, and I can't quite get a hold of it. As from the station, that's just little bits I've been picking up, and I'd have to call it the black world of those big cars.
Yeah.
That fella came in, and he had that old Oldsmobile. It was a 62 Oldsmobile, you know, white, and it's, spotted with rust. And of course, they always dress them up. They'll put two pillows in the back window, just little tiny throw pillows. And then they fade out in the sun and get dirty.
Yeah.
The cars are always a mess inside. And when Eddie told him, he says, "Why don't you get rid of that piece of crap?" The fella said, "What do you mean crap? That's an Oldsmobile." And there was a fella came in, it was Sunday, and he was driving a fairly new Chevrolet. It was the biggest Chevrolet made, and his tire was coming apart. It was just big chunks of his tire coming apart. And I says to him, "How fast you been driving?" He says, "Oh man, I've been doing about 90, about 100 miles an hour at times." And I said, "Well, you know, you get up that speed, those tires get hot and they'll melt. I mean, literally, they'll just turn back to like they were in the mold." And I looked at the tire again, and it was a recap. And an old recap will hardly hold up around town.
Yeah.
And he, that fella told me it was new. Well, this other fella had come in, black fella, and he was driving an old beat-up pickup truck, and, you know, had the back full of old brown plastic garbage bags. I figured they were full of aluminum tin cans, because they'd take them up and sell them for salvage on Mondays in Gainesville. And he was trying to buy a universal joint for a 62 Mercury station wagon. Now, those old station wagons are nice when they're new, but it's like something of fashion. Once the fashion goes, it turns to junk. So he was talking about that big station wagon to this fella in the car. Says, "Oh yeah, I drive at high speeds a lot. I do a lot of high speeds driving in that Mercury station wagon." I says, "Yeah, I was coming down from Tallahassee, this Chevrolet, I was doing about 900 miles an hour." And I thought, "You're going that fast, and look what you're driving. The car might be new, but you haven't got tires in there that'll get you around the block." And he said he thought it was a new tire. Well, if you just looked at the white wall on it, you could have told it was a retread. The fella came in. He has a Chevrolet wagon. It's a 57 Chevrolet station wagon. He's got the rear end jacked up. And it used to be yellow. Only now it's so dirty and faded and chipped, it's just kind of a gray. It did a little bit of yellow left on it. He's got a great big engine in it. Only the engine burns oil. He runs it fast, but it just dumps a cloud of blue smoke out the rear end. And he's got big wide tires on it and mag wheels. Only the mag wheels are always beat up and scarred from having been taken off and put on so much. And he came in, and he was in a little Pontiac Firebird that morning. He said, I need to borrow Eddie's air tank. So I let him have that. I said, you got a tire bad? He said, oh, no. I got me another GTO. I need to pump up the air shocks in it. He says, oh, you got something to run now. Oh, no. He says, I got it for $50. But I got another one I can get parts off, see. And I'm going to build me one up. Now, I was going to hop this one up here, but my old lady wouldn't do it. Yeah, I was going to get some tires in there and make this thing run, but she wouldn't let me. He drove off, and of course the car was shaking and needed a muffler real bad and a little smoke coming out of it. And then Sunday afternoon, a fella came in, and he was in a new GTO, brand new. Only the bumper was beat up a little bit where he'd run into things. It's got one of those rubber bumpers that are supposed to spring back, but they paint them, and the paint cracks when the bumper springs and peels off. But he had... He got out and he had on sunglasses and this pink shirt with a white collar and a white tie, dark maroon pants with a white belt and white shoes. Sure, I was a gas man. That'll fill that mother up. He goes in, I gotta make a phone call. Struts on in. And I'm washing his windshield and I look inside the car and see there are those two pillows in the back window. And then he's got, looked like a 38. The wood handle, chrome plated, and a holster sitting on right by the shifter, and then like a little hunting knife with a bone handle in a little case sitting there by the shifter too. He got a big powerful car and a gun and a knife. And he was just strutting. And he came out and we got to talking and he says, man, I just seen some racing. And I says, oh, he says, yeah, man. A 428 with two four bells and a 396 with just one four bell. And you know what happened? I says, no. Man, that 396 shut down that 428 and there was some money on that. And it was all blacks there. I bet you $2,000 changed hands. Well, I had 500 on it. I said, oh, you didn't lose any. Oh, no, man. I bet on that 396. What you got around here? I said, well, Eddie's got that Camaro there. It's got a pretty hot engine in it. In fact, he can't let the clutch out without the rear end taking off. So, well, how about a little 302 block? You can wind it really tight. No, I don't think Eddie needs that right now. What's he got in there? Who's got a 396 or 427 pistons? Oh, yeah. But he's having trouble with a carburetor. It puts too much gas. He says, well, that's what happened at 428 with two four bells. It just put too much gas in there. You know, you get too much gas in there, it's like having not enough. But now you need an engine. I got a 327 with two four bells. And it's, well, it broke a crankshaft. Just broke it right in half, but we got it put together. We got it in a 53 fold. And we got it going. We just got to get the kinks out of it. But you want a good engine, you let me know. And got it and drove off. And we had a vet come in.
Hello.
It was about a 66, 67 vet. Needing a muffler. And a ring job, he's blowing, you know, oil smoke out. And you open up the hood, and he doesn't have an air cleaner on it. If you want to ruin an engine pretty fast in dusty country, you leave your air cleaner off. And inside of a few months, you're going to have trouble because that sand gets in there and just grinds everything up. And he got out, and he had on white shoes and glasses and kind of a white hat. And he says, man, put in $3. So I popped the lid and dumped $3 of gas in there, and oh, that about fills it up, don't it? Well, it didn't. Man, I get this thing gassed up and go, I'm getting out at 4 o'clock tomorrow morning. I'm doing some driving, man. So I says, yeah, boy, you can go. I'm doing a little bit myself. I says, yeah, boy, and I get on the road, I tear it up. And then it came to me. What it is a whole world of these fellows driving these hot cars, and most of them are in bad shape. But they don't look at that. It all exists in their talk. And I can know as much about it as they do because they'll tell me. The whole thing just exists in their talk. And I don't care how bad a shape that car is in, it'll run. All dented, scratched, they'll have tires on there, and one, every tire will be different. They'll have four different kind of hubcaps. They'll need a muffler. They won't have air cleaners. They'll have the little pillows in the back window, and they'll be dirty and faded in the sun. And the interior will be a mess. And they're as proud of those cars and how fast they can drive. And it's all in the talk. And it's just come to me, just one incident per day, maybe. It's come together. And there it is, the whole world.
And they couldn't drive much.
No, they can't afford. There's one Cadillac that comes in with a different driver. It's a brand new Eldorado. And I have to almost get a screwdriver to pat. There's a little door you open to get to the gas cap. You almost have to pry it open because it's been run into back there. And he comes in. Now, Cadillac will hold over 26 gallons of gas, and it'll burn gas. You know how much he buys? He buys $2 worth of gas. And it's regular at that. And I always check under the hood, and the thing needs oil. Every time it comes in, it'll take a quart of oil. This car can't be a year old. It's got, I look in there, and you know, you think, Cadillac. And what's it got? It's got an alternator rebuilt by United Parts. And new hoses and new wires. In 1 year, it's wearing out. Now on the side, it's got this decal, you know, that used to have those little medallions that were had the stars and the stripes like American flag. Well, this is green and black and red. It says Afro. It's got this gold trim around it. He's got that on the side. Well, I haven't seen the same person come in with that car, you know. The first fella came in was named William. He usually drives a pickup truck. He came in kind of dressed up and strutting around and bought $1 worth of gas. And Eddie says, whoa, look, what have you got here? Will you just park that in your yard? He says, no, man, I just got a hold of it to drive today. It ain't mine, but just let me drive it today. And then Sunday, some other fella came in I'd never seen driving the same car. And then there's a guy named Lang, and he drives about a 68 Cadillac, kind of like Fanny had the last time they were down here, 68, 69, white. Only, it's got these initials, you know, they're stuck on plastic, initials stuck on the rear, on the roof line, and they're LR, something like that. They're not his initials. Well, he always comes in, but he's never driving. Some other fellow's driving, like just driving him around. And on a Sunday, he'll come in two or three times, and he'll buy $1 worth of gas. Regularly, put a dollar in, man. And drive off, and a couple hours later, come back in. Put a dollar in, man. Check the oil. And then I can see him. You got a dollar? No, I ain't got a dollar. Yeah. Hey, come here. I said, yeah. Put it on a ticket for me. Lang has credit there. And they go, wait a minute. Can you put it on another ticket I've already put? I don't want to get too many in there. And I said, well, no. You see, they're all totaled up. I've got to write a new one. Oh, all right. How much the oil? That's 85. Oh, okay, put a quote in. I said, well, it needs 3. Oh, I got a car. All right, put another one in. So I put 2 quarts of oil in this Cadillac, $1 worth of gas, and off he'll go. And a little bit later, he'll come back in, just sitting back with his hat cocked, you know, $1 worth of gas, man. And off he'll go again. And when credit gets a little too high at Eddie's, I think he stops going there. And he goes down to the little thrift station down the street. Probably has credit there. Because he doesn't want to get too many tickets. And he'll come in every once in a while and say, how many tickets have I got in there? You know, you got 4. How much is that? It's about $8. Oh, okay, good enough. He'll go on out. When Charles Davis comes in, Charles Davis has got an Oldsmobile. It's about 59. It's one of the real broad backs. And he'll come in, and I say, fill it up. He says, yes, regular. He says, you know what Charles Davis takes? Charles Davis always gets high test.
No. No, yeah.
I put high test in Charles Davis. It'll take about $2 or so. Once in a while, he'll fill it up, you know.
That's $2, right? You know. somebody in the family ought to know one of these patrolmen. They know all these boys and what
mm-hmm.
they drive.
Mary, Mike, Curtis.
No, Curtis not that far along.
Oh.
But Eddie should tell you there's one. It'd be 2 or 3 of them, you know, they know.
Yeah.
Dodd. Dodd. If not Dodd, ask the colored man down there. He'll tell you who's. Well, that's the next county. Does that matter? Well, anyhow. Buster. Oh, you can't get anything out of Buster.
Oh, that's right. Even Eddie's in the next county.
Oh, a lot of people would know that. That's amazing. It's amazing. They know all those fellas and what they drive. But I wouldn't know who. Eddie don't know?
I think he does.
But
I don't think he pays that much attention to them because he knows their cars are junk, most of them.
Yeah.
He's got that. He's a mechanic and he sees it that way. It's mostly just junk and cars
and
they can't afford.
And that's just in their talk. They don't really.
Yeah, the fast drive and everything. It's not really there. They're not good cars. They don't run well. But in the talk, it's all there. It's a performance. It's more in the talk, I think, than really doing it.
Maybe they just talk about going 90 miles an hour.
Because he said he'd been going 90. Well, if you've been going 90 for an hour, you won't be able to put your hand on your tire. His tire's just as cool.
Oh. Yes, I'd say, I forget his name, but the big colored fellow down at Dodge Gulf Station, and he know all those things.
Yeah, Eddie knows who he is. And Eddie said, just on that colored fellow, said he'll always have a job there. Apparently, Dodd's father left him the station on the agreement that the colored fellow had to work there. Didn't quite say why. Something's tied up in the family somewhere.
Oh, really? Well, he's good.
And the thing gets me is they'll come up and tell me about it now. Somehow I've gotten rid of a little of the Winn-Dixie or something.
Yeah.
I've gotten sultry almost. I just walk up and stand there. I don't say, what do you want? I just stand there. And it seems to work better. I just slow about my business and don't get the windshield quite as clean. And it just all seems to go better.
Yeah. Not too much energy.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be hard on an old Winn-Dixie man, would it?
But it's something that black guy just we must have stood there 5 or 10 minutes. He's talking away, and Eddie was trying to get the station closed. And he just told me all about that race. Proud. And I learned he don't ever try to pin him down just what the engine is. Because mostly it's more sound than it is a good engine. And if you pin him down, you kill him. It just takes the air out of him. Because this one fella came in a 55 Ford, and the engine's going boom, 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 boom. I thought, hey, man, what you got in there? It's just a 292. Well, that was the engine that came in the car. That's an old, worn-out engine, is what he's got in there, and he just had a muscle on there to make it sound good. And so I put a hole in the whole thing. Here he had the car all clean, and he was just as proud, all these people riding around.
And how did you put a hole in it?
I just said, what you got under there? And he had to admit that it was an old, worn-out engine. I should have said, hey, that sounded pretty good.
Oh, I see.
I don't want to know just what he's got.
I see. Just let him tell you if he wants to.
Mm-hmm. Most he's going to tell you, I got a full belt on it.
Yeah. Full belt, carburetor.
Mm-hmm.
Another one for you.
You haven't seen Burnett much over there.
He hadn't been by in a long time.
I saw him over there, you know. I ran into him. He was down on the side, and he wanted to know about I said, you got them big tires yet on your tractor? I started it. And he didn't have, and he was awed by the idea of putting out that much money. And I said to him, why don't you buy them from Farmers Mutual, the Farm Bureau, somebody like that. You can put them on, or they put them on. Save a little. Well, he says, how's I going to get there? Well, I said, Burnett, I never bought one there. But over there at the store in Evanston, they can tell you. They buy over there. I said, you trade over there? He don't trade anyway, you see, except soda pop. He sits there and gets soda pop at noon. So he's not, nobody much is obligated to Burnett, I'd say.
And he's got a great view. He says, that tractor runs, but that's all. He doesn't have a car. None of the cars run. The tractor does.
Well, what's the trouble?
Tears them up or takes them apart, one.
Yeah.
You've got to make a living off that tractor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's surrounded by cars.
Yeah. They're all junk.
All junk. Yeah. You're going to take him on this other thing.
That I couldn't really report on that.
Yeah, just read it. I'll just read it.
I think Don kind of got to liking that little bit of yurt on the service station, because when I got over to Crescent, he said, well, have you got any more on the service station?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was funny. When I hit the door, he told me it was a 12 house down, so I turned in, and I figured I had the right place because I saw the car. So I went on up, and I hollered out, and he said, you got the right place? And I said, well, I got it the first time. And the dog came up and barked, and I went on in. And just as I got in, Don was just about ready to spring out of seat. He says, have you eaten yet? I said, no. He said, good. And out of that seat. And he had his shorts on. He'd been reading a magazine. He said, let me get my pants. And just about 2 seconds, he was back in the room with his pants on. So let's go. And he looked like a little kid who was off to get an ice cream cone. And a smile and just delighted and excited. So we went all on out. And he said, you drive or me? I said, well, my car's there. Let's go in mine. So on down the road, we got to Little Green Arrow. Don had never said where we were going. I just drove. He said, turn just in front of that arrow. And he and Marie were kind of getting worried. I said, oh, wait. Now, this is the day before Easter. I bet they're closed. Do you see a lot of cars? It was dark, and I couldn't see. Until we got right on it, and it was jammed. And he says, good, they're open. And he says, watch the sand. It's a little soft. So I drove on down and finally turned around and parked behind a car. And we walked on up. And there was a line outside. And Don looked at it and said, it'll take about 20 minutes. It took a little longer. When we got inside, see, I'd been talking the whole time, trying to explain some about the talk and how it comes about, and I was saying how Miss Mary could tell us how she stopped Marvin from courting, with Marvin sitting right there, because it was public talk. And Don was shaking his head, and he was beginning to see a little bit. But I was talking to Blue Street. And Marie didn't say much of anything, she was just quiet. And Don was listening. And I was waiting for them to pick up their menus, so that I'd know, you know, see what they had.
It's this little old place off by...
Yeah, Cowboys. It's like right on the water.
Yeah, it's a little old place. They didn't have anything to eat in the house.
So, no, he laughs because we got four pieces of bread. Those are for breakfast. So, the waitress came over, and I was a little flustered because I started to look at the menu and everything, and then I thought, I'll just order what Don orders. And we ordered a platter, and Don said, I'll have scallops and a Miller. I said, I'll take the same thing. And as it turns out, that was just the perfect thing to do. I just happened by accident. So Don just kind of smiled a little, and I went on talking, and I was saying, you know, we don't have the leisure anymore. The regular jobs, if you get a day off, I won't have that day off. So we just don't ever have time quite to talk. And Don was going, yeah. He's shaking his head and thinking of his office and how the man can't come in and say in a few seconds just what it is, how he gets a little nervous. He's going, yeah, we don't have that leisure. And then the waitress brought the scallops out. And Don looked and said, oh, I want red sauce. And then Marie got her plate, and he traded her for red sauce. And he never missed a stride listening to me. And I wasn't paying too much attention, except I noticed he picked up the scallops right away and ate them with his fingers. Didn't even bother for his fork, just went right after him, dipping them in the sauce and eating them. And I dawdled around and ate my french fries and then ate my salad, and then I forked into a hush puppy. Well, you see, the scallops were fried, and they looked about like the hush puppies did, and I didn't realize they were hush puppies, and I bit into one. I get this bread-like thing, and I thought that was a scallop. And I was really disappointed. But I'll never get a meal off this kind of stuff. So I finished that, and I stuck my fork in again. This time I had a scallop. And I bit into it. It was warm, and it was sweet and buttery, and it was, oh, I said, this is fantastic. And Marie said, oh, are you saving the best for last? I said, no, no, I ate a hush puppy, and I thought that was a scallop. And Don just rolled. Just bent his head over his plate and laughed, and he had one scallop left in his hand. He dipped it in the sauce, and he says, they're good when they're hot. And then I got a hold of it. And he knew how to do that restaurant. He knew how to eat the scallops, and he never pointed it out to me. He just let me go along. Didn't say where we were going, didn't say what was good to order. But watching Don, I just happened to stumble into it. And then he just kind of opened it all up and said, they're good when they're hot. And there was such an ease about it, just an offhand remark, like an afterthought. And he smiled, and his excitement made the whole thing a pleasure. He made an occasion out of going to this little restaurant. We had to wait in line and park on a dirt road. I thought, you'd think you're in the most elegant of surroundings. And the whole time, he was enjoying his meal and eating his scallops, and he never missed a stride listening to me. And I don't think I've run into anyone who can listen as intently as he can. Pat Rambeau listens, but she's always going like this, you know, and wrinkling her eyes and everything. And it makes you nervous. And Don's just as relaxed as he can be.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know he's getting every word. And he'll just say a word now and then. I'm not quite clear on that.
I mean, Pat listens, she has to seem to listen.
Yes. And by the time we got back home, my voice was starting to get a little thin. So I set up a little bit and turned it over to them. They had this big old thick book there. It must have been that thick. It was a ring binder, a small one. I said, what in the world? That must be accounts. And he said, no, that's for flying. Those are maps. And Reeb opened it up and came over and showed me. He said, you see, these are the airport diagrams, and this tells how much kind of landing equipment they've got and which directions you come in. Well, I couldn't quite follow her because she went a little fast and it was all technical. And she was serious about it. And Don laughed and said, I was groaning at the size of the book. And he said, yes, you know, that's only for the southeast. And he says, now, if you want to add up north and out west, you ought to see the size of the thing. And Marie added, you know, and it has to be kept up to date every month or so. And Don just capitalized on it. He says, it has to be done every week. And he started laughing. And Marie was still very serious. And she said, we're just a little worried because we forgot our maps. And when you fly out of St. Augustine, you have to go around Jacksonville because there are three naval air stations there. And they're restricted areas. And the lakes you can't fly over because they're practice bombing ranges. And if you go in the area, not only do you break the law, but they don't take any responsibility for what happens. Don says, no, they come in fast and low, and you never know what's going to happen. And laughed at that and laughed and said, we forgot our maps. He just tickled no end. So I kind of kept that in mind. And then they had to get the weather since they were going to be flying. And I was talking. He says, we're going to have to edit you just a minute. Get the weather. And he turned on the little Sony portable. And it made a very nice break. It was late, but we could all look at the weather for a few minutes. Well, I didn't pay attention to the weather. I watched them. And they would just drop a word between themselves, you know, high pressure, you get the clear, yeah. And I could see they were looking at the weather like I'd never seen anyone look at weather. I thought out here I was kind of getting to pay attention to the weather. I could tell you if we had any rain in the last week and if that looked like a rain cloud. But they were very serious about it. And after it was over, they just went right back to listening and talking a little bit. It was no trouble. They didn't lose interest in me. We went on to bed shortly after that. But I kind of kept that in mind, too. And when we got up in the morning, I got up a lot earlier than them and walked down the beach a little and came back in. And Marie came out, and she was a little sleepy. She goes, oh, you're up. And she walked over and just turned on the radio like an afterthought. And the reception was fair, had a lot of static, and you could hear something like Morse code in the background. She just sat there, and I said, I'm trying to get the weather. And I said, that must be shortwave. I said, no, that's a low-frequency station, and they have to identify themselves with that Morse code. And this fella started reading, and he was reading visibility 6, ceiling 10,000, barometer 31.2, wind 61.5, 17, Claremont. And then he'd read something like that again. And he was rattling it off like that. And Marie was still kind of half asleep, going, And she was kind of getting pleased with the whole thing. And I said, I looked a little confused. She said, do you get it? I said, no. And the fellow's talking, and she's listening, and she says, visibility, she just filled it in, 6 miles, wind 61.5 degrees at 17 miles an hour, ceiling at 10,000 feet, that means there are clouds there. Barometer is 31.2 because we have to set the altimeters before we take off at the barometric pressure. Oh. And I said, well, I guess you all just pay attention. You're going to go flying to the weather. And no, it's automatic. And she kind of tilted her head up and looked up like she was looking at the weather. And said, we just know what it's doing all the time all over the United States. You have to know what's going to happen because you don't want to get caught in bad weather. Now he says there's high pressure up front. Now I know there's a low out west, but that high pressure's got that low stalled, and that's good because high pressure means good weather. And what it reminded me of was the way you said Papu always knew which way the wind was blowing and never seemed to pick it up. She can tell you the weather all over the United States half asleep and carry on a conversation. When Don came out, she would just say, high pressure, clear all the way to Atlanta. And I could be talking, and I'd hardly notice it. And they could talk about weather between them and listen to me. And it was like Cookie tightening a wrench and talking to somebody else. That same evening. So, I wanted to get a little more of the plane talk. And we sat down at the table. And there was Don and Marie, and Don had fixed some coffee. Made it a instant coffee in a pot and poured it in cups for us. And we had our four pieces of bread, toasted with butter on them. Don was tickled about that. Little bit of peach jelly left over. And I said, "You all don't fly, you know, by landmarks anymore, do you?" He goes, "Oh, no, it's pretty much visible." He goes, "You know, we can fly from Knoxville to St. Augustine and never take a map." And we said, "Well, I always like to have one." He grinned and said, "Well, we need one in one place. But you know, you just take a heading 158 degrees and you'll end up in St. Augustine." Where he goes, 168. And then I could see it. Don is just merry about it all. And Marie is so serious about the flying. And Don is, "We forgot our maps." He gets the heading wrong, but Marie corrects him, you know, "Yes, I'd like to have a map." Well, she's the instructor, you see. She has to be serious about it, I guess. But she never lets up, and Don is just kind of tickled the whole time with it. And made the whole thing entertaining the way he talked about his plane. And when he talked about his father's business, we got on to efficiency studies, and he was so proud because his business was the same size as his father's, but handled three times the business, you know, three times the work. And he said, "That's efficiency." And I said, "You know, the Florida legislature had an efficiency study once, and they were supposed to write down five times an hour what they were doing." I said, "Well, that sounds good, except that figures out to every 12 minutes. And they didn't have time to do anything but fill out the forms." And Don laughed and said, "Yeah, what we usually do is have one of those where you just write when you change a job. We just study the transitions. So you write returning to." And then he thought of it and said, "That'd be something in a gas station, wouldn't it? Trying to work on something, having to run out and pump gas, and always running in, returning to." And he got tickled about that and laughed.
"See, then had some fella out there, that's rude. We ought to keep something out there, you see, just to keep them up there. They are so handsome. He's looking right in here, but he didn't know it. He's eating that as if he's gonna steal it. And you know he can get a jaw full. Didn't we find out him in the Blue Jay?" "Now, can you listen to that and the other two?"
"Yeah."
"You were talking so much, what did Don what did he say about?" "He listened objectively."
"Mm-hmm. Yeah. I asked him, 'How can you listen so much?' And he said, 'Well, if you've got something I want to know, I can listen. As long as it won't take. But he's never strained looking. He just puts you at ease. And I have a kind of a picture of Don just bouncing out of that chair with that boyish grin off to the restaurant. And yet, his excitement made it an occasion, but he didn't talk about restaurants all the way. He left it open for me to talk and explain, you know, some of the methods and things we did out here. And he listened very closely and could understand a lot of it, I think. I remember I said to him, 'When you listen to Mr. Nealon's tape, you'll notice it can be kind of irritating because he's always trying to teach you something.' And he said, 'Yeah, yeah.' I said, 'But you see, that's not a fruitful category that'll get you into the tape. What you want to do is pay attention to those experiences before he got into the farm work and farm foreman and county agent, and see how his talk is completely different then. And so he picked up it up. He could understand.
That that blustery morning got him started right. And then he got stuck.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's just providential that morning, because that's the first human talk we ever had from him.
That's right.
Of all the times he stopped in here to talk, that's the only one that's
Mm-hmm.
Or you can use some of the other, like, say, you know, those comments on the field. Now, Mr. Cardinal's back up there, you see. And that's all old stale green. It's yet too old. And I ought to get some fresh. Just throw this away.
Well, I was sure you had some good fresh.
Well, I haven't had it, I don't think, in some time. I don't think I have. I'll go try it and see if it's fresh. And you want?
Mm-hmm.
Show mm-hmm. me. I don't know. I don't believe you can allow anyone to carry the ball for you. You got to carry it yourself, and they may see a little help every now and then. And there's always a temptation to tell people so much, educate them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I get stuck in. I know when I'm getting stuck, and I don't want to do it. And I don't much, you know. Now, you see, Wade, I told him I could see from what I had that particular experience that the grant was not for me. I don't know how I ever got the idea it was. Well, he said, you know, how, you remember that. I told you, if you, I forget who was here. I think just Wade. Were you here? And he says, now you just let it go. You just turn this over to me. I'll take this stuff home and I'll set it down and I'll get it down this week. Well, 2 or 3 weeks later, he hadn't got it down. But he says, you know, I want to work on this. As soon as I clear this tax return, because, you know, I'm really learning something. Well, you just keep me a poor man learning something. And that's my experience with all of them. Rambo will learn a little bit, Don Williams will learn a little bit, you see, and things that they don't need to know. They all seem to think, and you see, the Van Arnhems had a regular round table discussion of all this, brought in various people. They're trying to straighten them out. Well, they're not straight themselves. Whoever reads your grant won't know anything about it either.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's the thing of it. And every time you get scotched on explaining to people. Now my proposition to Faye, which you didn't get hold of, was that you could stay over here with Don, talk to him, and then listen to him talk.
Mm-hmm.
But I was thinking about it mostly that you could hear him talk.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turned out, you see, that Wild Goose Chase and They could have come back over here the next morning and just saved all that transportation. You can get into all sorts of rigmaroles if you want to, the useless ones. And then the useful ones, you see, you sit through. That mean on it. That's right. Just ordinary, straightforward, prosy, useful. So you set up there and just wait your turn. Hang on to them. Just keep checking in to the right people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you see, I don't know whose idea it was to send this to John and Russell. I guess in a desperate moment, I agreed to it. It wasn't my idea, I don't think. I don't know.
John asked for it.
Whose idea it was. But I've had, you'd think I'd had enough experience to keep my head out of the fire. And I went to considerable trouble, you see. I had to make the copies and write up something, you see, and then get it in the mail. That's a considerable effort for me. And after I did it, I knew nothing would come of it. They might pick up a little something, but it's not my function to see. Russell's never been down here, and when Don's down here, he doesn't take any hand in this. And if you could, I don't know, at the very best, it looks to me like you just get plunked down so much. Now, you see, the one person I rely on, I rely on number, but I rely on health some more. And he gave me those models to go by that didn't fit. After I got it made my business fit those models, he says, well, that won't help you, because all they give you is seed money. The whole state. The state committee just got $150,000 and you want $50,000. So I say that was lost motion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how to avoid that, I don't know. I simply don't know. Now, you know, I didn't know that you'd pick these things up. Now, you've picked them up, but you haven't followed through on them. So what you've done has been mostly lost motion. You see, she's a businesswoman. She's had right smart experience. And she hasn't even got a feet right yet. And not for her, you see. And you see, she'd be the one who'd get something going. I never have any luck, you see, playing the shooting the rifles or throwing the balls at the dollars. I never hit one of them.
Especially if it meant $300-$500 a month apiece for each one of them.
Yeah.
That'd be so nice.
Yeah. Never have any luck. I never have any luck at it. I hit the jackpot one time. That was over in Arkansas. It's quarters. The damn thing just filled the thing and spread out on the floor. And I picked up as many as I could and put them in my pocket, and I haven't played it since. That was in a Model A Ford. But I couldn't talk to the waitresses. See, he can't get into a restaurant. He went down to Trade Winds just last night, and all he got was food.
Oh, Rick. You mean Marcus Carter wasn't there?
Nobody was there.
Oh.
See, I wouldn't take it direct. I wouldn't take it direct or something like that. I'd go through somebody. I'd get Mr. Eastman to give me a little toehold over there, somebody. one reason I'm a little reluctant about just precipitately going over to Dixie County. I got some of these things Xerox yesterday, and I'm going to send Clay and Suzanne to three. I kept thinking they would send something to deserve it. But if I wait until they deserve it, I don't think they'll ever get it. You just can't imagine the generation that takes place. You see, Suzanne is scholarly. Her mind works. Or did. And I keep, she still wouldn't clean her typewriter ribbon. I don't understand. Debbie's the only one I know. Rick, I guess, cleans his, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He keeps clear. Don't you? He keeps all his machinery clean. Is that your father? Your mother both?
No, I don't like machines that don't work.
But that's your father?
I don't know where it comes from. I just don't like machines.
Well, your father doesn't either. And your mother doesn't either, does she? Or is that his influence?
Need.
Is that his influence on her?
I never saw a box wrapped so carefully as one that your mother sent you.
She keeps the house for her need.
Yeah.
But Dad keeps the car shiny and clean. Well, mine's not shiny and clean, but it runs well.
Well, we don't exactly encourage you to shine it up.
No. See, his...
Not out here.
He'll get to running better sometimes. I just don't like to put up with it.
Well, yes. I can understand the running. But the typing... It's just us get all choked up. The rest of it, hard to read.
Mm-hmm.
And she was, most of her time here, she wrote on a typewriter that she spent $20 for when it was new. And it wasn't Xerox at all. And then she'd give me the Xerox copy. I'd have to hand them back to her. It's hard enough to get the typewriter. She's educated.
She's right.
But she doesn't know. She doesn't clear it up now. That's amazing. Faye is one of the worst. And furthermore, she writes like this, you see, with her left hand. And her handwriting, you can't tell what the address is. Her letters don't get here. If she addresses it by hand. And she uses it right long hand. And Faye'd go in there and decipher it and type it. Now that's what we've had to work with. You see. So your angel was winged. I hope you have some influence. I'm sure you won't.
The secretary does to you. Teaches you how to type.
Yeah. Are you on your way?
No. Daddy wanted me to check in about 5. I got some other things.
Well, now, what's your schedule up at the... Those offices?
We just had
that was the offices.
Oh, I'll probably go in tomorrow and look in on
just
Sam.
Spend the day.
If I can get a hold of that one, that'll give me something to work with.
Well, now let me tell you. Whatever. Is that your only copy?
Yeah.
Just, well, you want me to look at it.
Give me a little toe hold.
Well, what you do, you go in and get something going, and if you need any help, you just holler and I'll come in.
All right.
And they don't have to come out here, and they don't have to know what the hell it's all about.
Yeah, that's why I'm just going to.
What you want to what you want to know is, I don't know, you can be a little bit more resourceful. The one thing that I found out is just ask them for a model to go by.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a whole lot easier than all that other stuff, the little directions.
Yeah.
You see, it takes a mastermind to follow directions. But if you've got something to go by, you're all right.
Yeah.
And the thing of it is now, I think I'm gonna put my major effort on this, and I'm gonna try to. I think I got it under my control now to the point where it won't. They don't want all that essay stuff, you see. That's where I sailed way off in the blue. They want all these abstract statements with a few definitions and maybe a little short, abstract type of thing.
Yeah. That's what I'm doing there. That's too long, but that's just to start working it.
Yeah. And once they start saying now, what sort of talk is this? Are you doing? Are you doing a structured one or unstructured? And you say it's neither one. And don't let them scotch you on that.
Mm-hmm.
Say this is talk on particular occasions,
mm-hmm.
and it's not in the books. But this is the sort that we have found gets what we were looking for.
Right.
You see, and keep moving.
Yeah.
And once if you let them get you scotched on anything, you see, you can't get them off.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you feel.
You can't get them off. And the way that you can get off of it and not get scotched in, just don't know what in the hell they're talking about. Just if they start on something, you start explaining something else. And just act dumb or something. There's a lot of ways to do it.
Put it back on them. Sure.
Everything but honest, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a matter of being dishonest, but it's a matter of not letting them trip you. Now, you see what I do, I'm sharper than most of them.
Mm-hmm.
That is, in mental statements and things like that, you see, I've done so much of it,
mm-hmm.
I can make a statement in easy language that they have to get all roundabout about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's embarrassing to them. Once you threaten them, that's a psychological term,
mm-hmm.
It threatens them. And that's what I do. Not seriously, you see, but you see that fella who's got that oral history over there, I wouldn't last 15 minutes with him because I'd undercut him.
Yeah.
Because the damn thing's not worth doing, my estimation.
That's right.
Although I'd like to see what they do. But you see, I've got no reason to look at it, and it's not in line with anything I'm doing. and by no stretch of imagination are we doing lower history.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all. Now, Suzanne's got, you going over there? Well, you going over there? Suzanne had a note there that she had picked up this Robert Coles, and they didn't have the migrants volume that we had, but she got the middle class one,
mm-hmm.
where he's trying to get something out of the middle class and find that they don't know how, there's nothing to get. Mm-hmm. And the reason I haven't put the thing out here was that it was so crummy, I didn't read it myself there for a week or two, figurated, and so I wasn't missing anything. But I'd lay it out here ordinarily.
Mm-hmm.
If you hear of anything and you want to get it, just go in there. find it, just ask. Just bring it up and I'll get it for you.
To do with any kind of sentiment. I mean, you couldn't even admit you loved your own mother, much less that you loved a little boy who was your own age. And so they started teasing Liz about Johnny's frank and open face, and they made up a little sign that was Johnny's frank and open face. Johnny, said B, had a very round face and a little puggy nose, and he was covered with freckles, and he had ears that stuck out and hair that just stuck up like this. So what they did for Johnny's frank and open face was to make a circle, and then they'd put lines coming out of the top of it, and two big ears, and dots all around like this. And then they drew it everywhere, all over town. They'd take chalk and draw it on the walls. They drew it all over Liz's school books. They drew it on the headboard of her bed. And Bea said she, in this little story that she wrote, she said that she went back to her hometown and she was thinking, you know, it's all changed, nothing's the same anymore, and she had to look down the sidewalk and there was Johnny's frank and open face in the sidewalk, and she said, my gosh, I did that when I was 11 years old. And so the what she wrote was the day when she drew Johnny's frank and open face in the sidewalk, in the wet cement. They were just laying the sidewalk, and it was Christmas Eve, and it's charming. She talks about the colored servants. She said we called them the colored servants, the colored people. They were just learning Latin in school, she and all her friends. And so they would decline the names of the servants. Like the cook was Cora, Corai, Coram, Cora. And the groom was Lucam, or something. They would yell these names, and she said Luke thought it was a great game to pretend that he was offended, and he would chase you when you called him these names, and just chase you all over the yard. And so they loved it that he'd chase them. The cook would never do anything about it; she'd let them decline her name, but Luke would chase them. And it was Christmas Eve, and she had she'd gone to get some candy for Tess, the older child. Liz was Tess's younger sister, and she's the one that loved Johnny with the frank and open face. And she went over to their house to help them stretch their stockings for Christmas. She said, they said in her family, they had flannel stockings that were made big enough. But in Tess's and Liz's family, they used regular stockings, the Buster Brown kind that were advertised with Buster Brown on one side and the dog on the other side pulling them. And they were supposed to stretch, and she said they used to stretch them down to their waist. They'd put them on over their head and stretch them down to their waist so that it would be big enough to get all their presents in on Christmas morning. And she said this Christmas, Liz decided that what she'd do would be get one of her mother's stockings that would be a little bit bigger, and maybe she could get more into it. And so Bea stood up, and they stretched the stocking all the way down to her feet to get it big, and then they hung it up, and Liz had bad feelings. She decided that if this stocking, there were two things to consider. One, she wasn't sure if she believed in Santa Claus, but if she did believe in Santa Claus and Santa Claus came, what would he think about this big stocking? And if Santa Claus was really her mother, what would her mother think when she saw her stocking stretched out like this? So they put it back. But they had a Sunday school party that night, and they all went to it. And Johnny with the frank and open face was up in the front of the Sunday school because his father was the preacher. And so Liz's sister started teasing her about Johnny, and said, look, there's Johnny. There's the frank and open back of his head. There's frank and open ears. And Liz was terribly, terribly embarrassed and slid down under the seat and stayed under the seat for the whole thing until the very end, when all the children went up to go get a present from Santa Claus and they called Liz's name and she wasn't there. And so her sister took her candy and they wondered what had become of Liz, and they started to feel badly because they'd been teasing her about Johnny. And they got back to their house, and there was a trolley track down the middle of the street. And there was Liz lying in the trolley track, and they all went running up to her, V and her brother and extraneous cousins and Tess, Liz's sister. And they said, "What are you doing there, Liz?" And Liz says, "I'm going to lie here till the trolley comes along and chops my head off. I'm just going to lie here till the trolley chops my head off." And they all told her, "Well, you can't do that, Liz. You better get up now. It's Christmas Eve. You can't lie. I'm going to lie here till the trolley chops my head off," Liz said. So her sister says, "Well, as long as you're going to stay here, you might as well have your candy." And she gives her candy. And Liz starts to eat it. And then B's brother looks at her and says, "Well, you're going to have a long wait because it's after 6 o'clock and there won't be another trolley till 8 o'clock tomorrow morning." So they all went home and left Liz eating her candy on the trolley track. And the next morning, B went over to see what they got for Christmas, and she realized that there was Liz in the house, and she thought, I guess she didn't spend the night on the trolley track after all. So she said to Tess, "What happened with Liz? How'd you get her off the trolley track?" And Tess said, "Well, Mother went out and picked her up. She'd fallen asleep. She said, you know, she's not in love with Johnny anymore. She got a book about King Arthur for Christmas, and now she's in love with Sir Lancelot."
Okay, here be telling this.
Lively.
Have you heard her tell it?
No, I didn't hear her tell it. That's the little piece she wrote.
How did she write it?
I think it's nice. I enjoyed it. It's, well, she finishes her sentences and things like that, but I liked it. It's, I suppose it's a little mechanical in the beginning because her reason for getting back into this story about Christmas Eve is seeing Johnny's frank and open face on the sidewalk. And then she pictures herself as a child, as an 11-year-old child drawing Johnny's face. But they used to do, and all of it, she never went to school until she went away to college. She said, and I guess, well, she was talking about her father a little bit and said that all they studied was Latin and Greek and math in college, and you were supposed to learn everything else yourself. And so they learned everything themselves at home.
That's right.
The only grades they had, and they sent one of her brothers home from college. He wrote a very nice note. The head of the college wrote a very nice note and said, "You know, I'm sorry, we just can't keep him. He's just not a scholar. We'll keep the other boy. He has a 98 in math and a 100 in Latin and a 97 in Greek. We'll keep him, but we just can't keep. He's not a scholar. He's a fine fellow, but he's not a scholar." Send him home. You talk about the 19th century. It's beautiful. Beautiful.
Yeah.
And they used to have, they used to steal things all the time. They used to steal penny candy, she said. They couldn't steal anything more than a penny candy because that their conscience would bother them then, but they could steal things that were 2 for a penny or something like that. And the problem was, of course, to steal it without being caught, without getting caught. Oh, and I know what she... When they were building the Methodist church, she was a Presbyterian. They were building the Methodist church, and a new Methodist church, and while they were building it, she and her friends discovered that they could climb up in the dome and get in the scaffolding, and they built like a tree house in the scaffolding of the church. And they took mattresses up there, and they took books up there, and they took food up there, and they just had this little playhouse in the dome of the Methodist church, which was all fine until the church was finished. And then they realized that it probably wouldn't do for them to be dropping orange peels on the congregation, so they knew they'd have to move out. However, it was a little difficult because then there were people in the church and they had mattresses in the roof. So he says, did it just one thing at a time. They'd go up and sneak out a book, or they'd climb up and sneak out a flashlight or something. And she was going out with a mattress one day, and she started to walk through one of the Sunday school rooms. And as she got into it, she realized that there were people behind her. There was going to be a Sunday school class in the room. And so she ducked into a closet and spent 2 hours in the closet with her mattress until the class was over. It'll be interesting to see what comes of it. To see, I mean, it's to see how well she can go beyond just telling the funny incidents. Mm-hmm. If she can actually describe the dome more, describe the children more. I'm not sure exactly what more there should be. She's not really circumstantial, but she might be if you keep her on it. Instead, I mean, I just talked to her for about 5-10 minutes about it. She talked about the dome and the cousin who rode across the river to ride her horse, and then she gave me the story. So we didn't talk.
Well, you just have to get into it
and see.
Yeah. You try not to direct it, but you try to hold it open so there will be circumstantial, you know. And that, in a way, is directing. See on tape. After, you know, once she's going, you wouldn't stop her and just let her go.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I don't know how you do it. But somewhere along the line, you see kind of what she's got down and what she hadn't put in. And somehow, not asking questions. You lead and lead back over some of it seems. That's the way. That'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
That's the way to learn it, you see.
Mm-hmm. I think it's always surprising to me how strongly people react to talking like that. It's sort of I don't have the right words for it, but it sort of reaffirms them. Mr. Weaver loves to talk about himself, and he said when I left, she said. She's been sick and she hasn't been feeling well. And she said, you know, this is the first step forward I'll have taken in a couple of months. All I do is go around picking up the pieces. And this will be something positive. I mean, mm-hmm. Is this going forward instead of just standing still?
Yeah.
comes at a good time for her.
Well, you see, she doesn't know exactly what you want to say. Things have to come to her.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably see things too, you know. And that'll be nice. And I think ideally, you see, you'd just be with her a good bit. And you get little points. The childhood part of it doesn't appeal to me very much. I wouldn't pay much attention to the dates. You like Faulkner, just go from one generation to another. Just however it works out, you see.
Yes, she did that. She was talking about her brothers and her father in college and skipping generations. And
when she gets old enough to report on things, does she see it? Did she ever live there as an adult?
I don't know.
If she didn't, she won't know much about it. As you know, as the experience out here, going back doesn't help you. It's living there as an adult and just living the life other people live. Then you get into it. As a child, you don't know much. And I never have just started in with someone who was willing and interested. I worked with Lois Dixon, and what I got out of it was her. She related things like her trips to the Bach Tower, but it opened her own mentality.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, not abstractly, but where you could see it. A feeling for it, and that was that's where I got the word Edwardian, to see something that happened before World War I. If they mature before World War I, they're quite different. And in a way, I suppose that would be kind of like the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
It lasts as long as they last.
Mm-hmm.
It's more, you see, a 19th century. Be nice if you make a living doing those things, right? After you learn, you know, get fairly a little skillful at it.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can enable people to say what they don't think, don't even know they know. Of course, Bee's been scholarly all her life.
I don't know.
Public affairs?
She reads enormous amounts. My sister has stayed with her before, and she said B reads about a book or two a day. I don't know.
She has
always been interested in politics, too. She takes a strong hand in it.
Oh, does she?
And she's, she was on the operating table practically, and she and Fitzpatrick just came to blows.
Yeah.
They disagreed on politics. She threatened to get up, get off that table. And she meant it.
Now, you see, something like that would be much more interesting to me, and she could recapture that.
Yes, just as I was leaving, she was talking about going to her eye doctor, Dr. Casey, and they throw insults back and forth, and she uses the Kleenex, and he says, "Hey, you've had two already. What do you think? I made out of money. You can use in my Kleenex like that."
Jean Herbert said she was pushing her to have a little get-together for two of these girls, women who are running for the commissioner. Jean Chapman was the Sherman girl. She said, B kept saying, "Now, you ought to do something. You ought to get the word around. You ought to do more than just knock on doors." So Jean said she'd probably have a little get-together for him because B needed to.
This is the end of Debbie's report on Tuesday at supper, 24th of April, 73. This is the end of Debbie's report on B. Fox. She's planning now on taking down B.'s story of her childhood in West Virginia. This Tuesday at supper, she's by herself. Rick is somewhere or other. This Tuesday, the 24th of April, 73.
This would be a different kind of thing. I think that screw is
how about this?